No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, home of the 2019 Major League Baseball World Champion Washington Nationals. Yay! And America's Last Colony. I'm joined by Maria Sanchez, my co-host, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype questions to BBS Radio. BBSRDIOPR. We're happy to have a special guest tonight, Maria, are you there? My co-host isn't with us yet, but she'll be here in a minute. And we have a special guest tonight, Adam Winchy, who is going to talk to us about what's going on in the Middle East, because we really don't know where we go from here. And Adam is a researcher covering Afghanistan and Pakistan with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He is also a PhD candidate at Boston College and instructor at GW University, who teaches classes on international security and military effectiveness. And Adam served in the United States Army and completed two deployments to Afghanistan in 2007 and 2008. And we're really happy to have him with us tonight. Adam, are you there?
I am. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Before we move on, let me just say that our legislation on Capitol Hill has a new co-sponsor. So shout out to Congressman Greg Stanton of Arizona's 9th District for standing with us. We really appreciate that. And Adam, maybe you could start by explaining to us exactly what the mission of the Quincy Institute is.
The Quincy Institute is, broadly conceived as an action-oriented think tank that seeks to lay the foundation for a new foreign policy that's centered on diplomatic engagement and military restraint. I think, stated simply, it's a think tank that would like to see peace as the norm in the world and war as the exception.
Well, God bless you for that, because that's important work. It doesn't seem like we're getting any closer to it, Adam. So maybe you could tell us what's your opinion of the latest situation in Syria, where we seem to have on one day withdrawn troops and then we're just moving them around. And now, I mean, what's going on over there? Do you have a clear picture of what the situation is? Does anybody have a clear picture of it?
I think you can get a general picture of it at this point, but, I mean, it's still a very, very fluid situation. I was reading a report just before coming on the show today that there was, they're getting reports from military leaders that aren't really sure what their mission is in Syria. It's a fascinating situation, and it's especially fascinating for us at the Quincy Institute, where we see a situation in the United States where a majority of the public supports the idea of getting out of these sort of endless conflicts that have no sort of foreseeable end in sight. And, you know, seeing politicians both with the Democrats running for president and from President Trump himself when he was running for president, you know, voicing support for getting out of these endless wars. And then to see when these situations actually arise that they have either no interest in getting out of these conflicts or they just don't understand how to actually get that done on the ground. And so we see that happened very clearly in Syria, where you get an order from President Trump about a year ago saying that he wanted to get out of Syria, and then we just didn't really see any movement on it. And then one day in October, the President Trump decides that he's going to pull troops away from the border with Turkey, and then we see sort of a Turkish military offensive that, you know, goes after, you know, partners of ours that have been working really hard, the United States going against ISIS. But then even after that withdrawal and all, you know, all the horrible things that came along with that because of the poor way in which it was done, we see, you know, even after that supposed withdrawal that we're now moving troops back into Syria. So even after a withdrawal, we're at a point now where the troop levels are essentially where they were before Trump decided that he wanted to pull the troops out anyways. And so it's being done, our foreign policy is being done in a very imprudent way, and in a way in which these forever wars that the American people want to get out of are not actually ending.
Well, let me ask you, what's the Quincy Institute's position on this? Would you guys like to see us out of Syria? Do you think that's that should be our short-term goal here, is to get out?
So my response to that would be absolutely. That the original mission for troops to be in Syria in the first place was to sort of, as President Obama put it, to sort of degrade and destroy you know, the territorial holdings of the Islamic State, and that is, you know, for the most part that's happened. And then what happened once that did occur, these troops that we left in Syria just sort of stayed there, and we let them, both the political and military leaders, sort of search for new missions for them to accomplish, right? So once they dealt with ISIS, they were now tasked with, you know, countering Russian influence or countering Syrian influence or countering Iranian influence. And those are missions militarily that just can't be accomplished with acceptable costs. And it certainly can't be accomplished with the small number of forces that we kept in that area. And so they're essentially being asked to complete a mission that they were never going to be, you know, capable of doing in the first place. And so now you have a situation where those troops in Syria are, you know, targets for our adversaries, and now we're sending more troops to protect those because they're targets. And so you just sort of get this cyclical, train of events that, you know, these forces are just adding on to more and more forces. And so we think that U.S., you know, goals in Syria can be accomplished without stationing military troops there, and that those military troops are essentially just targets. And it's draining resources from, you know, other, you know, missions that they should be focused on, like countering China or, you know, other missions like that.
Well, what about the Kurds? Have we, you know, what we're hearing in the media, right, is that this has been a terrible thing because we've abandoned the Kurds. What's your opinion on that? Have we abandoned the Kurds?
We have absolutely abandoned the Kurds, and there was a horrible situation that happened with them. I'm certainly not going to try to defend the way in which this withdrawal had occurred. But in our name, it says responsible statecraft, and I think that's what we're sort of seeking here, right? So you can have a withdrawal from Syria that manages the situation so that you don't have Turkish, you know, forces thinking that it's a free-for-all and going after partners that have worked with us for a really long time.
Right.
And so as far as I understand it, you know, the United States is one of the only countries that can talk to both the Turkish and the Kurds at the same time. And so we should have been doing that from the very beginning, because we knew from the very beginning of this sort of counter-ISIS operation that working with the Kurds was going to be a problem from Turkey. And so from the very beginning, we should have been envisioning what, you know, the aftermath of this, you know, anti-ISIS campaign would have been, and we would have worked out a power-sharing agreement. We could have found situations that were acceptable to both sides. But instead, we didn't sort of plan for the aftermath. And then when we did go for the withdrawal, rather than having a managed withdrawal that sort of, you know, kept tensions low rather than escalating them, we just had this sort of haphazard decision by the president, and it wasn't really well executed. And that's what, you know, I think led to the big problems that you see with the Kurdish, is, the way in which the withdrawal occurred, not the fact that a withdrawal happened at all.
Well, isn't that a very hard thing to accomplish, though, what you've just outlined, because of the way the Kurdish population is spread out over four countries? I mean, you've got them in Turkey, Syria, Iran, and Iraq, right? And that's great. Our co-host is here. But you have them over Turkey, Syria, Iran, and Iraq. Isn't it really hard to try to negotiate, since it seems to me that they not only interact with the United States, but then they play both ends against the middle, right? They also negotiate with the Turks and the Russians and other players as well, the Iranians.
Right. Right. I think you're asking important questions. I think what we should also be looking at is what the alternatives are, right? I think some people were concerned that we weren't, offering protections to the Kurds, which is an interesting point. But at the same time, the United States cannot give indefinite permanent protection to everybody that works with us at any given point, right? And so we don't have the ability, or, it's not within our interest to, provide permanent protection for the Kurds, or, try to establish a state for them themselves, because that would enter us into conflicts with all these other states that don't want to see that. And so the best possible situation that we could have seen from that is to negotiate a sort of power sharing agreement that was acceptable to the Kurds. It might not be, their ideal, but they were never going to get their ideal to begin with. So we could negotiate a deal that was acceptable to all sides. Now, I'm not saying that that was easy, but it was better than the alternative of just not giving the Kurds any warning whatsoever. That was, I think, the biggest mistake is not, informing the Kurds that this was going to happen so that they could work out a sort of, power sharing agreement that would have worked for them.
Well, Maria is with us now, and she probably has a question. But before we go any further, I've been remiss, Adam, in not thanking you for your service. I know that you were in the Army. Are you still in the service? Are you in the reserves, or are you out?
No, I'm out. Yeah, I did about 2 years in the National Guard when my first contract ended. So I did about 7 years total.
Well, thank you for that service. And Maria, are you with us? Do you have a question for Adam? Okay, I guess Maria's not with us. We heard she was with us. But anyway, Adam, is there any chance that you see in the future, since I'm somebody who fights for statehood every day, is there any chance that the Kurds are going to have a state? They had a state for a while, did they not, in Iran in 1946? But is there any chance that they will someday be united in their own state? Do you ever see that happening?
I see it as extremely unlikely, given the fact that their sort of territorial homeland is sort of spread throughout states that already have interests in, power interests in maintaining that territory. And I think that's one of the issues that I think concerned Turkey so much, is that they saw the United States working with the Kurdish on the Syrian-Iraqi side of the border, providing them with weapons and training and resources. And I think their concern, and the concern of a lot of countries in the region that have Kurdish populations, is that boost in power and prestige and credibility would eventually lead to a situation where Kurdish in their own country were sort of seeking their own state, which they have been, obviously, for a long time. But they were concerned that this would give it, more of a push than I think it would otherwise. I think the difference, obviously, with the DC is that, with the Kurdish, they're working from sort of outside of the political system, trying to establish a state, as sometimes, through force, whereas, in our own area, we're hopefully working through a democratic process where the states could sort of find an agreement. So I think that would be certainly possible. But I think for the Turkish and the situation that they find themselves in, it's extremely unlikely.
So what impact does this have? I mean, it seems to me that we've still got a long way to look to see how this is going to pan out. It really hasn't. Everything seems to be in a state of flux right now. Do you agree with that? I mean, it's going to take what do you foresee as the future for the Kurds right now, the immediate future? Turkey seems to be encroaching, and so if you had to advise the Kurds, what would you tell them? Would you tell them to move back from the border and regroup, or what would you tell them?
So it seems unlikely that they'll be able to move back to the border if Turkey maintains their sort of influence over that area, which they seem intent on doing. What I would advise them to do, which is would be exactly what they did immediately after this sort of surprise, hasty withdrawal that they saw, which was they immediately reached out to Assad in Damascus and, you know, tried to reach some sort of power sharing agreement where they would sort of have this, not necessarily semi-autonomous, but more autonomous than other regions in Syria in exchange for Assad taking that territory back and protecting, sending forces into that area and protecting them from the Turkish offensive. In that situation, that was definitely the best case scenario for them. They were losing the protection of the United States unexpectedly, and so they had to find protection from whoever would give it, and at the time that was Assad. But that was before the United States decided to send its forces back, as Trump said it, to protect the oil or to get the oil. So now we have, it's about 900 troops in that region of Syria, which is, I think about 100 less than what was already there before. And so now you're in a situation where, the Kurdish don't really know who's protecting them or who they have alliances with. And then the Syrians can't move in to fulfill that role that they sort of negotiated because, the U.S. is moving back into that area and they don't want to see a direct conflict between the U.S. and Syria. And so now you just see a situation where everyone's just kind of in a stalemate. And I think people are just kind of waiting to see what the United States chooses to do or what Turkey decides to do.
Well, is there any chance that they will turn to Baghdad and to Assad? Didn't Assad gas these people?
Saddam certainly did.
Saddam did.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm confused.
Yeah.
It's such a confusing situation.
It's a very confusing region for sure.
It really is.
And that's one of the interesting things about the Kurdish is that everyone thought that the United States abandoning the Kurds was damaging to the United States credibility and that we weren't going to be able to work with allies anymore. But the reality is that, unfortunately, we've abandoned the Kurds many times before, and that hasn't, stopped them from, working with us when it was in their interest. And it actually came out that during the Baghdadi raid, that raid was sort of facilitated by information that was given to us by the Kurdish forces at the exact same time that we were abandoning them to the Turkish military offensive. And so I think what people misunderstand about credibility is that people work with the United States because we have sort of a common interest, which for the Kurdish in the U.S., it was, fighting ISIS, and because the United States has the capability to do these things. And so if, in the future, interests align again and we have the capabilities to do something, that's not really going to stop, our past behavior isn't really going to stop people from working out with us if they need to.
Well, let me ask you, because this has been sort of a major theme that we've seen develop on media throughout the United States on this particular issue, is that this affects our credibility with other partners around the world. Do you think that's true? Do you think that our credibility is affected by the fact that there's this vision that we have abandoned the Kurds, or this idea that we've abandoned the Kurds? Does this hurt us diplomatically in other areas?
So, it's a very interesting question, and you're right that the media has been, jumping all over that sort of narrative. And I think it also gets risen as like a concern for leaving Afghanistan or pulling military forces out of Afghanistan, as well as, if we abandon, our allies in Afghanistan or we abandon our allies in northeastern Syria, that people won't see us as credible or reliable allies, and so they won't work with us anymore. But the reality is that past behavior is a very poor predictor of whether or not people will work with the country. If you're in a crisis or if you have something that you need to deal with, generally what you're going to look at is, do these countries have similar interests and do they have capabilities to do, what they need to do? And so we don't really see past behavior sort of predicting alliances or partnerships or anything like that. I think it damages our reputation, but the extent to which that will affect alliances is that sort of causal chain just isn't there. And I think especially with other allies, if you're looking at East Asia and, you know, Western Europe, I think those situations are so different from what's going on in the Middle East that I don't think those allies are the least bit concerned that, you know, they're going to be abandoned next.
Well, I have to agree with you. I think necessity is also the mother of cooperation,
right,
as the mother of invention.
Invention.
So, yeah, and it's such a, you know, I'm still sitting here trying to figure out the difference between the PYD and the PKK and the YPG and the, you know, I can't even figure out who all the actors are. So tell me, what do you see, how do you see this affecting what else is going on in the Middle East with other Arab nations and Israel and, you know, the conflict that has existed for 2,000 years almost between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Is this having any effect on those other things that are going on and our other interests?
Yeah, I think it's hard to tell exactly what impact this will have in the broader region just because it's so in flux right now and so chaotic and nobody is really getting a clear idea of what's happening so far. What I think it does do is sort of allow people to point at the chaos and the confusion that's going on and use that as sort of a way to criticize anyone who, you know, sort of calls for a withdrawal or a military withdrawal from the Middle East. And what we've seen over the past about a year is President Trump has added about 12,000 troops to the Middle East. And I think this chaos and confusion sort of gives them, you know, the reasoning and the legitimacy to sort of add more troops there because, you know, they're in danger. There's lots of chaos going on. So I think it'll provide justification to sort of increase these, you know, never-ending wars rather than pulling back from them like he has promised so many times.
So that's not a good thing, the fact that we're adding troops, and you see that as an exacerbation of the situation over there rather than any kind of amelioration of the conflict?
Right. So what we see a lot of times, especially in the Middle East, but I mean, this happens all over the world, but military force, whenever we deploy it, often creates, you know, this chaos and these dangers that are often justifications for the use of military force in the first place. And so what you see is adding more troops to deal with a threat that is coming from the fact that we deploy troops in the first place, right? So when we found that 12,000 troops have been added to the Middle East in the past about a year, the justification that was given for that is because, you know, the troops that were already there were threatened by, you know, sort of the Iranian regime and, you know, other issues that were going on. But instead, if we had taken rather, you know, a more de-escalatory sort of stance and we, you know, gave more effort into like diplomatic efforts, economic engagement, things like that, then that would be less threatening to these countries. And then therefore our troops in those regions wouldn't be threatened. Therefore we wouldn't need more troops. And so adding more troops sort of just exacerbates these threats that military troops are supposed to be sort of dealing with and bringing to an end.
So May I interject here?
I'm sorry. Now we have Maria.
We had technical issues, but I've been online and listening the entire time.
Okay,
but
good.
To interrupt also. Adam, first of all, thank you for taking the time and making yourself available to us. And
of course, thanks for having
given
me.
Given the broad brush strokes that you've been speaking with the senator about, can I ask you, how is it that the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft is uniquely poised to share these positions with us via you?
Mm-hmm. So what's really unique about the Quincy Institute, one, is that it's pursuing a foreign policy of restraint, which is not something that you commonly see in D.C. Commonly what you see from think tanks in D.C. is that we need more military engagement, we need, you know, more sort of forces, more military, more of everything. So the Quincy Institute is saying that we need to take a more responsible sort of track with our foreign policy, have more responsible statecraft. And I think the Quincy Institute is also unique in that we consider ourselves transpartisan. So rather than bipartisan, of, you know, we're one side trying to work with the other. What we are is a collection of people from every side of the aisle. So we have, you know, working with us just in general, like within the office, you have people from the right and the left. And Quincy Institute was, you know, very, very famously started by grants from both the Charles Koch Institute and George Soros Open Society Foundation, which are two people
wow.
who usually cannot agree
what great
on anything.
Pedigree. Yes.
Yeah. So I think the Quincy Institute is trying to take advantage of a very unique time in American history where these ideas are being supported by people on both sides of the aisle. What's missing is, you know, sort of the Institute to sort of push this idea and to show that there's, you know, there's very legitimate scholarly research to back this up, and there's a very real interest within the American population to support, you know, this this foreign policy of restraint.
Well, you know,
and what does
go ahead,
may
Maria,
I ask?
I'm sorry.
So,
yeah.
Thank you, Michael. Adam, what does a day look like to you as a member of the Quincy Institute? Do you have a debriefing to start with, or are you assigned tasks and you bring that to the table to share what it is your brain trust knows? Or how does it look?
So it's very interesting that you bring that up, because we haven't even officially launched yet. And so we are we're in the very early stages of actually getting started. So my day goes between, you know, researching issues on Afghanistan to writing, you know, articles and op-eds about various issues. And then I'll go put together some bookshelves because we don't have furniture yet. so it's a very, very interesting day for me.
Well, you know, first of all, Adam, let me tell you that Maria and I'm sure I speak for Maria too, we're very intrigued by this, because this is what our show has tried to do. We've tried to bring
yes.
people together from both sides to talk so that we can start a dialogue, because we truly believe if you can't, you know, if you don't have a dialogue, you can't get anything accomplished. You know, we had somebody from the Cato Institute last week, for example, and, you know, we have liberals and conservatives and all sorts of people on the show. So if you accomplish this, the next thing we got to figure out is how to get you up to Capitol Hill so you can teach those guys how to do it, because, you know, obviously yep. they can't agree on anything. And what do you think about that? What do you think about the fact that the country is so divided right now? What impact is this having on our foreign policy?
I'm not convinced that the country itself is as divided as people think that it is. I think that the media, in the way that we sort of have this conversation, whether it's online or, you know, through different op-eds and outlets, I think that sort of incentivizes this, like, you know, the loudest voices from the farthest ends of the political spectrum to sort of clash with each other. And so it gives that sort of image of being very, you know, very, you know, polarized in the country. But I think if you go and talk to average people, and if you ask them what they think about these ideas, you find that there's actually a lot of agreement. And I think especially with the idea of bringing these forever wars that have been going on for, you know, nearly 20 years now, that there's very broad support to bring these sort of things to an end. And I think you can find other things that are sort of similar to that. I think the way that we sort of engage with each other is broken, engaging with each other through social media, things like that. And that gives that appearance of being, you know, very polarized. But I think, you know, in reality, the country can find things that they very much agree on.
So what do we do about them? Any suggestions of what we do about that? Because it seems to me that all aggression stems from fear, and as long as we're fearful, we're going to be aggressive. How do we mitigate the fear? How do we interfere, if we can, with the media to get them on board? Because I think, you know, it's in their best interest to have confrontation, right? It's mm-hmm. you know, nobody wants to listen to CNN if CNN is saying everything's all right. They want to listen to see what's happening on the other side. So any insights on how we can, you know, have a more responsible media in this regard?
I think you ask a very important question, and I don't think that there is a very, you know, simple answer to that. I think it comes from, you know, a lot of organizations and, you know, efforts such as your own to sort of broadcast these these radio shows and efforts by like the Quincy Institute and other organizations that are trying to bring these issues that are supported from all sides to bring them together. I don't think it's certainly not a perfect solution, but I think it's at least gets us a little bit there.
But you, what the cool thing is unlike media that the senator was referring to, Adam, at least the Quincy Institute seems to, because of the seed money that you were given, you can kind of forge your own way. Because, Michael, I believe you were referring to the adage that if it bleeds, it leads. Yeah. And to that point, about 8 years ago, I tried to start a good news channel, got nowhere. No one wants to hear about what's going right in the world. Yeah. Everyone wants to hear about what's wrong. And I tried every day. It was a live broadcast Monday through Friday and only talked about what happened well and good and right and couldn't get any traction.
Yeah. That's an unfortunate consequence of where we stand these days. So tell
but
us.
But I like that, though, that the Quincy Institute started with seed money that's formidable so that hopefully you can forge a path and get people to follow based on your examples and your principles and what responsible statecraft means.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a very interesting point about, you know, where our sort of funding comes from, because I think that sends a really clear message to people that we're not, you know, one side of the aisle versus the other. We're actually working mm-hmm. with both. And I think it's interesting, too, because I think, you know, a lot of people have been sort of, well, not a lot, but some have, you know, raised concerns about, you know, where funding for the Quincy Institute is coming from. But what they don't realize is that, you know, a lot of these think tanks in Washington, D.C. are taking money from, you know, Middle Eastern countries, you know, foreign countries that have very specific interests. And so I think once they realize that, then they realize that, you know, getting, you know, grants from both sides of the aisle is actually a pretty good thing.
Well, yeah, and I've never heard transpartisan before.
Yeah, me either.
I think a lot of people might use the word bipartisan to describe it, but I think that what that is better at describing is, you know, one side of the aisle trying to find some way to work with the other side, which isn't really what we're doing. We're not really one side or the other. We're not, you know, we're not conservative. We're not liberal. We're, you know, sort of a collection of people from every side that are working on something that we know everybody sort of wants to get behind.
Well, you know, I think that your very existence is an important thing, because if you can do it, maybe others can do it as well. So tell me, what are your priorities at the Quincy Institute right now around the world? If you had to pick those things that you think are most important to work on to bring your concept to get, you know, more peace and less war, what are your priorities right now?
So there's two major projects that we're starting off with, and these are going to be released as soon as, you know, once we get launched and get up and going. One is going to be, the project is called Ending Endless Wars, and the other project is sort of democratizing foreign policy. And with that, the intent is to sort of end, you know, the post 9/11 authorization of the use of military force and the sort of executive branches, you know, taking the Congress's war power away from them and taking that further away from, you know, the public sort of being able to have a say in whether or not we go to war or not. And so those are two really big issues that I think that we're pushing on really, really heavily right now. Just sort of trying to find a way to have our country think more, you know, more democratically, more seriously about when and how we sort of engage in these wars. Because right now it's too easy for the executive branch to sort of just engage in any war that it feels like it needs to. And I think we see that pretty clearly in Syria, where, as far as I understand, there's no clear authorization for the United States to be waging a war in Syria. But we can use the authorization to use military force after 9/11 to say, you know, the military is going after terrorists, therefore it's authorized. But what we want to see is to have that the power go back to where it was supposed to be, which is with Congress to declare war.
And so you would press for legislation to remove the executive power to intervene? You would do that? I mean, that's the kind of solution looking for Congress to say, we no longer need this. The power is now ours again. Is that correct?
It's certainly a dynamic that needs to change. I think the authorization to use military force was formed at a particular time where people were very, scared and very concerned, and rightfully so, about, terrorism in the world and how it was going to be dealt with. And so they gave very broad powers to the executive to go, and sort of execute that conflict. And now we find ourselves 20 years later where things have changed dramatically, and we still find ourselves at war, fighting terrorism, which is a tactic, not necessarily something you can go with the military and find it and destroy it. And so under those circumstances, we have a situation where we have the legal authority to wage war endlessly, and you have no need for Congress to sort of step in and say, yes, we authorize this. And so we certainly want to see that brought back to Congress and to think more seriously about how and when we get engaged in military conflicts.
Adam, may I ask how it is that you became acquainted with and associated with the Quincy Institute? I always like the backstory.
Yeah. So essentially I believe I'm the first official hire. So about a year or so ago, there was a group of people from all sides of the aisle that got together and decided that this was the right time to do this, to start this institute. And I was always, as a graduate student going through my PhD program at Boston College, I was always interested in foreign policy restraint. I was always following the movement, and I, knew that the Quincy Institute was a thing that they were going to get started. And so I constantly, refreshed their website, waiting for job postings to come up. And when they did, I applied as soon as I possibly could.
And well, as a doctoral candidate, can you tell me what that journey was like for you?
Yeah, that was an interesting journey. So I joined the military right out of high school. I very naively thought that I was going to miss the war. That was back in 2005. So that was only 2 years after the invasion of Iraq. But I graduated early from high school, took summer classes, graduated early so I could join the military early because I thought I was going to, miss something. Turns out I wasn't missing anything. And so once I was done with my contract, I went to college, finished my undergrad, and then went to Boston College for a master's, and then, started my PhD, and that's when I started getting into, issues of foreign policy and restraint and things like that.
And since Maria's brought up the backstory, tell us why is the Quincy Institute the Quincy Institute? Is it based on something that John Quincy Adams said? Is that
it
true?
Is, right. So in one of his famous speeches, he said that the United States goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. And what we see now is that's essentially all we do is we find these monsters and we try to go destroy them. And I think the war on terror, that framing specifically, has sort of enabled exactly that. That we, if you think that terrorism is this monster that the U.S. military is the most effective tool to go destroy, then you're going to find monsters essentially everywhere. And so that sort of, foreign policy that John Quincy Adams warned about so long ago has become, essentially the basis for most of our foreign policy decisions these days. And so, yeah, that's what it's based on.
Well, as the power dynamic changes, I assume that this policy that we have to be the, often called the world's policeman, right? This stems from the fact that after the Second World War, we were so much stronger than all the other nations of Europe, all the other industrialized countries, that we took this position. As the power dynamic changes and we have more, we see the rise, for example, of the Chinese economy and their presence in the world. Do you think that there'll be a natural tendency for this dynamic to change?
So what's interesting about that is that the reason that this has been a 70-year foreign policy that has been completely unchallenged is that during the Cold War, after World War II, during the Cold War, you had the Soviet Union, which, was gaining enough, power and influence that it was becoming a vital threat to the United States. And so that was sort of the basis and justification for this foreign policy because, the United States finds itself in a very advantageous and very well-protected position, being surrounded by two oceans and two very friendly countries. And so that's very different from other world powers who have been surrounded by threats, right? So any power that rose in Europe would be surrounded by, you know, adversaries that would try to sort of counter that rise and that power. So the United States is in a very well-protected position. So the only really thing that could potentially threaten the United States or the existence of the United States is if another power were to consolidate power in either of those flanks, right? So if a power were to consolidate in Europe or a power were to consolidate in China. And so the threat of the Soviet Union consolidating its power in Europe sort of drove this foreign policy of being deeply engaged in the world and making sure that the Soviet Union couldn't accomplish that. The problem is that things have changed significantly, and that's still the foreign policy that we're pursuing. And so instead of focusing on the rise of China, which could plausibly consolidate power in East Asia, we're instead focusing, you know, 40 to 50% of our military forces abroad in the Middle East, where there is no, you know, real vital threat to the United States. There is sort of peripheral interest for us there, like the flow of oil and terrorism, things like that. But we don't see any real vital threat there, but we're still sort of spending all of our military resources there. And so I think changes in the, you know, international relations should have shifted that foreign policy, but we just haven't seen it shift like it should.
Well, that's a very interesting point, right? I don't think anybody in the United States is worried about Iran or Iraq or Turkey invading the United States. Mm-hmm. You know, we really don't see them as a threat in that sense of the word. Maria, I don't want to monopolize all Adam's time. Do you have a question?
I do. Adam, I'm interested, too, in what you think short-term the Quin City Institute will be able to enact, knowing that these are long-term goals, because we're talking mm-hmm. about sometimes generations of thinking with how we approach enemies and war.
Right. You're absolutely right. I think short-term there are some options that would definitely get our foreign policy on sort of the right track, and that you're also right that there's also long-term goals of sort of, you know, rebuilding the State Department so that we can effectively engage in diplomacy. But I think short-term there's a lot of really clear objectives that we could sort of push for. One of those is, you know, withdrawing from Syria and having a clear and organized plan to withdraw from Afghanistan, I think is also something that would be very advantageous to sort of end these, you know, these small wars and get focused on what are more vital threats, such as China.
So what do we do that? What do we do, Adam, to generate support for the Quincy Institute? First of all, mm-hmm. if you have a website, please give that to our listeners. But also, what is the Quincy Institute, and how can we help get America behind this idea that I mean, it seems that they're behind the idea that we shouldn't be involved in endless wars, but how do we get them behind the idea of diplomacy rather than military action?
Right. I think you bring up a very good point, because it's not something that is, you know, it's not something that people think of as, you know, a very strong and effective response to things, right? So we see threats in the world and we're trying to tell people to, you know, take a really, you know, measured approach to things and don't, you know, don't send bombs, you know, send diplomats instead. And I don't think people have gotten used to the idea that, you know, America is strong and we respond, you know, very strongly. The problem is that we just don't get the results that we think we're going to get from the use of military force. But I think for trying to support these measures, you know, if they support them, which, you know, the majority of the American public does, I think there's lots of ways that they can get involved. One is to sort of ask these questions of their politicians and ask them, you know, do you support these ideas? You know, how are you going to support them? Do you have an actual plan to get this stuff done? But there's also lots of organizations out there that are also sort of pushing for this restraint of foreign policy. You know, Quincy is not the only one. I know that, you know, Cato Institute that you mentioned earlier also has very similar ideas on how foreign policy should be organized. There's an organization called the J.Q. Adams Society, which is similar to ours, but it's a sort of college-based sort of grassroots organization that works to, you know, build student clubs on college campuses. So there's lots of ways to sort of get engaged in this, in the push for this sort of policy.
How about liberal organizations? I mean, you know, we're liberals. We're supposed to be, you know, peaceniks, right?
Progressive.
That's what they used to call. Yeah, that's what they used to call us. Are there any liberal organizations involved in the work you're doing?
For sure. There's definitely organizations that are involved in that. One that comes to mind off the top of my head is called Win Without War. Which is a very good organization that's sort of pushing for something similar. And I think it's also interesting to see the sort of the Democratic, you know, presidential campaigns and how they're going and how they're sort of framing these discussions. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of movement on the progressive side as well.
And have any of those campaigns reached out to you for information? You know, I'm a political campaigner, been involved in lots of campaigns. Mm-hmm. And what we generally do is we seek expert opinions from people to help guide our policy positions. We're out on the campaign trail. You know, you have an education advisor and a military advisor and so on and so forth. Have any of them reached out to the Quincy Institute, or are you guys just too new for that, do you think?
So we are very new, and so people are still sort of getting around to even recognizing that we exist. But we have had lots of people reaching out to us to sort of see what we're all about, see what we have to offer. And I think we generally reach out to as many people as we can to say, you know, this is something that, you know, we're working on. If you agree with it, then we can, you know, help you with, you know, finding the scholarly research to help it, writing articles, things like that. So we're working as much as we can to help people who are, you know, on board with this restrained foreign policy to help them do what they need to do to actually enact it.
And do you have a website?
We do. So it's Quincy. So it's quincyinst.org for Quincy Institute. We have sort of a generic one up now. Once we launch, which should be around the end of November, we'll have a new website up that has, you know, some of the research that we're working on, some of the, you know, issues that we're, you know, doing research on and, you know, trying to get advocacy on.
Great.
And actually, the working website, Adam, is pretty darn good and informative. You know,
yeah,
your home, your team, your principals, and donate of us, you know, of course. I thought it was fairly straightforward. And, of course, red, white, and blue. And your logo was catchy. So whatever you guys have done, you did well.
Yeah, I like the logo as well. I think the website, I mean, there hasn't been a whole lot of effort put onto it because, you know, we're working on the launch and, you know, getting everything right for that. And so I think the fact that it is as good as the website is, I think, is a reflection of how passionate everybody who's working with Quincy Institute is about, you know, getting this done and getting it done right.
And so the principals are located, I'm sorry, Michael, under
no,
the
go
team.
Ahead.
No, I mean, I know your principals are what you stand for, but under the team, that's who's actually guiding, hiring, inspiring, informing, and directing you?
That's right. That's the founding group, and that they have been essentially running everything for as long as this has been an idea, and they've been doing a very good job at it.
Nice.
Well, and what can we do, not only here on Shadow Politics, but what can we do as citizens to help you? How can we reach? Is it a matter of reaching out to our respective members of Congress, or, you know, if you could instruct America how to get behind this movement and push, what would you say to them?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, the majority of Americans, you know, support this kind of a foreign policy. And I also, you know, from what you see from, you know, Donald Trump's campaign and also from the Democratic presidential campaigns, you see that even politicians are supportive of this. I think what the next step requires is, you know, asking them to, you know, follow through with those promises and asking them to, you know, give real plans on how they expect to do this. You know, one of the things we're working on at Quincy is, you know, developing an actual plan for how a military withdrawal from Afghanistan might look. And to my surprise, I haven't really found one that exists yet. Despite, you know, lots of politicians talking about, you know, support for getting out of Afghanistan, they haven't really, you know, developed these plans to do that. And so I think, you know, reaching out to, you know, your congressmen, senators, whatever, and asking them, you know, what do you, you know, do you actually support this? You know, what's your plan for actually getting this done? And then, you know, holding them to it when it comes time for election, which is coming up very soon.
Holding them to it is the key there, I think.
Yeah.
And it most certainly is.
And we're running out of time here, believe it or not. But first I have to ask you, how do we get the Quincy Institute interested in supporting the 700,000 people from the District of Columbia who need to get involved in the conversation? Is that an issue you guys would look at, or you only consider international affairs?
Well, we're certainly focused on foreign affairs, but I think one of our big pushes for, you know, the democratization of foreign policy. So I think that's very much in line with what you're trying to do in the district, trying to get a voice.
All right. And let me just ask you, Adam, before we let you go, I'll give Maria the last question. But is there anything that you want to add that we haven't asked you?
No, I mean, it was an hour. I mean, I could talk for, you know, as many hours as you have airtime, but
we'll have you back. We'll definitely have you back, because this is so interesting to me, and I think it's so important. I'll let Maria speak for herself, but I think it's what you're doing is such important, groundbreaking work, and that's why we wanted to have you on the show, and we're so glad you came, and we hope you come back. Maria, do you have any more questions? You always have a question. Do you have any more questions?
Well, of course, but Adam, what was it that inspired you to choose the journey that you did from public service, thank you for enlisting with our military, to then getting your degrees, to then doing this kind of international policy work? Did you have a mentor? Did you have a...
I certainly had plenty of mentors along the way, too many, I think, to list here for sure. But I think for me, this entire sort of path has always started from 9/11. From that event, it was no question in my mind that I was going to go into public service of some kind. And, you know, the Army was just what I thought fit, you know, best. And then once I was in, I realized there was a lot that I didn't know about the world. And so I wanted to go, you know, go to college and get, you know, better informed about the world. And then once I did, I realized a lot about the fact that, you know, the mission that we were doing in Afghanistan was not, you know, was almost always destined to not be effective in the way that we wanted it to be. And so, you know, that's what sort of led me to the Quincy Institute and finding a better way to sort of engage in foreign policy. So I think it all sort of comes back to, you know, where I was on 9/11.
Well, I think we all need to be better educated. And thank you again for being on the show. Adam Winchy, we really appreciate it. We wish you all the luck with putting together the Quincy Institute and getting it up and rolling and making a difference in America. I know that Maria and I will, you know, be happy to have you back on anytime you're interested to talk about what you're doing, because we think this is really important work.
It is.
Yeah, and we're going to leave you tonight. You know, we always leave with a song, and this goes out to Adam and all the people that work at the Quincy Institute that are helping put it together, because we think it's very important. I'm going to violate one of my basic principles tonight, yes, which
Uh-oh.
Is not to talk
Adam,
about...
you're guilty.
Not to say anything about Christmas until after Thanksgiving, but unfortunately, of all the songs that fit this particular guest and what he's trying to do, I think this really hits the nail on the head, and it's "Someday at Christmas" by Stevie Wonder. And we'll see you next week. Thank you, Adam.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Adam.
Someday at Christmas, men won't be boys, playing with bombs like kids play with toys. One warm December, our hearts will see a world where men are free. Someday at Christmas, there'll be no wars when we have learned what Christmas is.
Representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.